we have to have all these different systems to run a business, essentially. But what I'm excited about is the idea that data warehousing, which has traditionally been an analytics environment for mostly backward-looking, you know, analytics, looking at historical data, maybe doing some predictive modeling, but it's always been a side gig for the rest of the company. It's informed a lot of decisions, of course, and it's helpful. But as I, you know, a lot more recently too, we've seen this trend of pushing data warehouse data back into operational systems so that those systems can, you know, be better informed and essentially do more, you know, for less, or do it more smartly or more optimally. And as that continues to happen, we're going to see a merging of operational applications and the data warehouse to a point where the data warehouse becomes an integral part of any company in terms of running the company and running the business.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Lewis and Kyle Show, where you get to listen to awesome interviews with inspiring entrepreneurs, investors, authors, and a whole variety of other fascinating, super interesting people. Today, we have Aaron Clymer on the show. He's the founder and CEO of a company called Data Clymer, which is a pretty large data consulting firm that works with major league sports teams like the San Francisco Giants and the Las Vegas Raiders to help them understand all of the data coming in and out of their business, building proper infrastructure, making great decisions based on analytics, and a whole lot more. He works with a bunch of companies that are major league sports teams. Those just tend to be the sexiest and most exciting. Before this, Aaron spent 7 years building the data team at Salesforce, which is kind of where he got really good at this whole building large data teams things. This episode covers how Aaron started his data company and grew so large so quickly in terms of personnel and in terms of clientele. We discuss how he ended up in data in the first place, despite studying something pretty unrelated to data in college. We discuss the most exciting trends in the world of data. He loves data, so there are a lot of cool trends. We discuss how dramatically data infrastructure has changed just in the past 20 years or so. And we also, towards the end, discuss what it was like for Aaron to grow up living in multiple countries instead of just in one place. That was also pretty interesting, if you ask me. As always, listeners of the Lewis and Kyle Show will know we discuss much more than what I summarize in this 30-second blurb before we get started. Anyway, I'm going to switch to a brief word from our sponsor, and then we'll get this party started. Enjoy. This episode is brought to you by our friends at VASA, the Virtual Assistant Staffing Agency. We hired our first virtual assistants from VASA to assist with our operations running the show back in June. But VASA is not just for podcast editors. If you need some extra hands to free up your time, let VASA help you with hiring for administrative, technical, and creative work. That's graphic design, cold callers, social media managers, sales reps, video editors, admin assistants, and more. Free up your time to focus on your highest impact work and learn more about VASA at vastaffing.agency or by clicking the link in the show notes to schedule a free strategy session with their team. Alrighty, back to the show. Aaron, welcome to the Lewis and Kyle Show. We're excited to be chatting today.
Thanks, guys. I'm really excited to be here. Thank you.
I want to start out, you're just telling us kind of before we had started that you've had a kind of winding career, kind of a bunch of zigs and zags, and during your 20s, you didn't really know what it was that you were going to be doing. What was your, when you're graduating college, like, what did you think you were going to be doing?
Oh, man. Yeah. When I graduated college, I had a degree in geology, actually. So I was studying rocks. I loved it because it was camping for credit. I got to be outside. I got to explore the world. And I really had no idea where I was going with that necessarily. I just, and I feel like it's kind of my life in a way. I just kind of go where something interests me. And I, it's kind of the circuitous path. That's the journey. And that's the point of life anyway. So I just enjoy doing so many things and going so many directions. I thought I was going to keep going with that. I mean, I went straight into the PhD program at Berkeley. And I studied with Walter Alvarez, who's a famous geologist who sort of discovered the theory of the dinosaurs becoming extinct by asteroid impact. And I thought that was really interesting. And I actually did my master's. I ended up getting a master's and did all my studies on asteroid impacts and mass extinctions. I thought that was a fascinating, understanding of the history of the Earth. And about 2 years into that, into the PhD program, I decided, that's it. I don't want to do this. It's either academia or maybe oil and gas. Or, I wasn't really sure where else I could go with the geology itself, some environmental work perhaps. But none of that was, I wasn't passionate enough about any of that to just keep going. So, it's all about circumstance and timing as well in your life. In my life, that happened to be the dot-com boom. Well, that was a good time to get in high tech. I like to joke that as long as you had a pulse and you could think a little bit, you know, you definitely could get a job in high tech. And so I just pivoted. I said, I'm going to get out and probably going to go into high tech. But that's exactly what I did. And I never looked back and have always been so happy that I made that decision.
So you were already in the Bay Area at the time.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. I was living in Berkeley and going to Cal and getting my degree there. Yeah, so then I stayed there about 20 years and within a variety of roles, all Silicon Valley kind of high-tech stuff, everything from software engineering. But I started out as a software engineer, Java developer, and I kind of, we could spend the whole show on some interesting .com stories, but I got a job at .com 2 weeks before the IPO in 99 and had a Corona beer while I did my first interview and drew a few database tables on a whiteboard, and I was hired, and it turned out to be the highest flying stock in 99 on the NASDAQ. It was just this crazy company called Commerce One they'd invented web services. They had the patents on SOAP APIs. You know, I mean, they were inventing this platform that all commerce was going to go through. So how do you value that, right? It's like all business should go through this, you know, platform at some point. So those were crazy days where we were all experimenting, you know, with the internet and not knowing where it was going. So but that got me into high tech and loved enterprise software and enterprise data applications. And stayed there again, like 20 years. I just moved to Minnesota this year. So now I'm a Midwesterner again.
What was the crash like?
You know, what do I say about the crash? I feel like I either have a guardian angel and I got really lucky. It didn't affect me all that much in terms of longevity, I guess, of some of the jobs I've had. Because of this company I was with, Commerce One, had done so well right up into the crash and had actually accumulated something like $1 billion in cash for major players like SAP and Microsoft. Everybody was investing in this, wanted to have a piece of it. And so they had cash to burn. They burned through that money for 6 years during the crash. So I kept my job that entire time trying to help the company recover. It didn't really work out. But I finally, after the crash, then, you know, I was considering moving around, and I actually used that story to I actually got a scholarship through my alma mater that funded my MBA. The scholarship the essay I wrote was all about trying to turn this company around that I thought had great vision, just poor execution. And so that led me into my MBA at Berkeley. And during that time, I took a data science course before it was called data science. It was really predictive modeling and targeted marketing for purposes of marketing, and learned how to build all sorts of predictive models and deal with data. And that's really when the light bulb went off in my head that this is exactly what I want to do with the rest of my career, is data specifically. I was doing enterprise software and a lot of data-related applications and a lot of database coding, but not pure data and data warehousing. So I pivoted my career again and got directly into data warehousing and actually went straight into Salesforce after that. So that's past the crash, but the crash was, the crash didn't feel as much of a crash to me personally. And so I kind of skipped a lot of the pain of that. So I guess I don't have a whole lot to say about that. And again, this is my guardian angel story. Ironically, I started at Salesforce in 2008, right when the next crash hit, the 2008-2009 sort of recession. Salesforce sailed right through that, didn't even slow down in growth. So again, I didn't really feel the pain there. I gotten really fortunate and really lucky over the last past 20 years.
This might be the boring question to some people, but what did data warehousing look like in like 2007, 2008?
Yeah, it was a night and day. I'm still extremely amazed at the amount of innovation that has happened in that space just in the last 10 years. It was all on-premise, first of all. At Salesforce, we were running an Oracle data warehouse. So I started at Salesforce and I ended up running the data team. There really wasn't even a data team when I got there. Another kind of crazy story of a largest cloud company in the world and very data focused, but still it was not about data internally. And so we were running on an Oracle data warehouse there, and it was pr- pretty horrible. You know, it was very slow. You definitely could not bring in all your data into one place. You only had to bring in the most important data. You often spent a lot of time writing or creating aggregate tables that were summarizing a lot of data for you because the raw data was too large to query directly, you know, or let end users touch the raw data or the low grain data, I should say. So it's just a lot of work keeping that thing up. It was also, it took like 10 times the amount of staff and people to run it. You know, you had to have at least one or two DBAs and they're for this is a company, let's say 3,000-4,000 people, large, a medium-sized company at the time, to just do nothing but keep the lights on with the data warehouse, you know, and everything from storage constraints, capacity planning, to compression techniques, to, sort of the way you approached all your table design, all that stuff. So it took all these roles that today we don't even really need anymore because the vendors have taken care of a lot of those headaches and technical aspects of data warehousing. Now you can focus much more on the business. It was also about at least 5x expensive because of that. You know, a lot of it was the resources of the people you had to hire and have on staff, but the software itself was really expensive. And those were the days when you purchased software just by how many CPUs it was going to run on, how many cores, how many servers, and it was millions of dollars for what now you could get for $100,000. You know, so prices have come way down, performance has gone way up, headaches have gone really away in this area. I mean, I should say totally away, but it's like night and day. So it's been, that's one of the things I just really enjoy about being in the space today is how much faster we can get to the business outcome that we're looking for.
I'm curious briefly before we dive into, the rest of the story, that moment where you found data and you're like, this is what I want to spend the rest of my life on. Like, what was that like? And you know, it's pretty unique, I would say. I don't know many people that are like, okay, data, this is it. So what was that moment like for you?
Yeah, it's like love at first sight. Come on, we all know what that feels like. That's it. Like when I met my wife, I knew it. Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with my personality as well. I like having data guide a lot of my decisions and show me kind of the way to a solution or to an outcome I'm looking for. Sometimes I feel like I'm not the most intuitive person on the planet. I have a hard time going out there with no data and just, executing. So I've always personally just wanted data to support my decisions. So it was a combination of like really just naturally gravitating toward data for my own reasons. The other piece of it was really understanding what data could do. You know, up until then, again, I've used data to build applications, done some analysis, a little bit of reporting, dashboarding, but I had never really seen predictive modeling, for instance, in its entirety and really dove into that area. And when I think the first case study we looked at, which was the quintessential case study in predictive analytics back in the mid-2000s, and still is relevant, is Netflix. You know, Netflix back then was still the poster child of really leveraging data to, very nth degree of business value. So back then it was still a lot of DVD rentals. There was some streaming going on, but they had predictive models that could predict within 85% accuracy which customers are going to leave within 6 months. And I thought that was amazing. I was like, that's powerful, super powerful. And any business could predict, a lot of things just using the data they have. It's just a matter of organizing it, putting it together, figuring out what you want to predict, and then, working on doing that. So that case study in particular, just, I don't know, it just meant something to me. It really opened my eyes to a lot of the possibilities of how businesses could leverage data. And I just thought that was fascinating. I loved it. So I did everything I could to get into the field.
What would people look at for making that prediction? Is it like what about someone who's never looked at anything related to this? Like, what are you looking at that tells someone like that you're predicting the future in like a high level way?
You're saying how would you approach that problem, or how did Netflix
more or less?
Yeah, and it turns out just most predictive problems are somewhat intuitive. I mean, you often know what variables might be causing an effect. You're not sure, But you created Kether, a data set that Netflix had done 20, 30, 40 variables of usage patterns that customers had. You know, you obviously, you want to talk to business analysts and experts in the business and get their, what are their two cents? What's their hunch? What do they think is driving, you know, an outcome like retention or customer attrition? And then you see if you can measure that, put it into a variable, a model, create a target. What are you targeting? Is it attrition? You know, how do you measure that? And then run it through predictive algorithms, often many, and see which one, you know, seems to be working well and all that. But it takes a lot of, you know, to do it right, you actually want a lot of business input into what metrics are you even going to consider that could be driving your outcome.
Was it only that one course you took in school? Because you kind of like in the story, the way you told it just now, it sounds like, yeah. You know, you, and I guess the additional question is there a lot of software engineering in geology education? Is that like a thing you have to like, where was, that was kind of also a gap that Kyle may have had as well. Like,
yeah.
And I got a job as a programmer, or is that just because you get on the whiteboard?
You know, there might be today. The fact that I was taking school, we did do some interesting modeling actually in my undergraduate where we would model systems. And so you'd be able to create a complex system by modeling out basically nodes in the system and watching flows of whatever it is, through the system. Once you've created it, you know, kind of click run and see what happens. And what we were trying to get at was modeling actually earth processes like global warming, you know, even global warming, you know, what are this, you know, what are heat sinks? What are carbon sinks? What are, you know, how does temperature change if you do this or this? So yeah, it's modeling, but nothing, that was really analogous to the data world that I got excited about. So it wasn't much of a bridge there for me. Yeah. And yes, it was just that one class, really. The rest of the classes were, I loved business school. I was on the edge of my seat for all of it. I just loved the ideas and all the aspects we talked about, whether it's finance or marketing or team building, organizational structure, all that. But it was just that one class is what really, really, really struck me. And I just focused on looking for data jobs specifically as soon as I, you know, basically took that class. And I was lucky enough to have a pretty strong network. You know, one of the nice things about a part-time MBA, which I took 10 years into my career, is that you already have 10 years of experience. You have a career, you know, you have a network, and all the students are about the same place in their careers. So you know, they already have a big network. So the network effects that you experience are pretty big, and you meet a lot of people and you make a lot of connections. It's kind of half the value of the MBA in my mind.
So at what point do you do data work on your own? I know there's a couple companies between Plimer and Salesforce. There's probably a whole bunch of stories in the middle, but at what point do you kind of decide that you're going to strike out on your own and do this independently?
Yeah, so I had crossed my mind quite often, even 10 years before I started the company. And I always thought, There's services work out there that'd be really interesting. It was only a half-baked thought, you know, it was an idea. I didn't really know how to get started. I was pretty risk averse too, which is kind of funny because I feel like I'm always a conundrum. Like I'm an adventure seeker. My first memories are of adventurous things. My parents were always doing adventurous stuff. We were living all over the world and experiencing all this stuff. So on the one hand, I'm an adventure seeker. On the same hand, when it comes to maybe in my financials, I'm a little more conservative. I don't know. I had two young kids at the time too. So I always felt like I didn't have the flexibility and the financial resources and all that to start my own company. Of course, in retrospect, I wish I had because it was a lot easier than I thought it would be, you know, because you just do it. You know, if you have some experience and you have some skills, you know, you can just do it. Perseverance is a big thing. You do have to persevere, right? But if you know, if you can map out how you can work out the first 6 months, you know, then the rest will come into place and will fall into place later. So but I guess I was trying to probably be more conservative. I finally left Salesforce, you know, primarily because ironically, internally, I mentioned the Oracle data warehouse we were on, that even then that was getting a little bit antiquated. There were other cloud vendors that were coming on scene. There were some powerful business intelligence tools and analytical tools like Tableau. And unfortunately, the culture at Salesforce was use Salesforce technology for everything you possibly can. Build all of your internal apps on Salesforce, you know, do it all in Salesforce. We need to show the world that you can run your company on Salesforce, which is true for a lot of business processes. But for data and specifically, that was a pretty big challenge. You know, we didn't really have a data warehouse per se. We didn't really have a business intelligence tool that was flexible and well built yet, you know, at the time. And so I was really kind of forced into using antiquated technology. And after a while, I just wanted to get more into the modern cloud data stack. And so I eventually left for a lot of those reasons. Another funny side story or interesting side story is I spent about 2 years just clawing tooth and nail to get Tableau into Salesforce. And when I finally did it, we rolled out Tableau Server to about 300 people and it was pretty successful, especially compared to some of the older legacy BI tools we were using. Like we're using Business Objects, which is now SAP, and I just could never get users to even use it. It was so hard. You know, the usability, the UX was so difficult. So the whole thing was very clunky. Anyway, getting Tableau in was like a breath of fresh air, and it was great, but it took me forever. And then, you know, a few years later, Salesforce turned around and bought Tableau, and now it's everywhere internally, right? So I sort of lived through the hard times there. But after that, I went to Pop Sugar, and I led data there for about a year and a half. And again, it's all these pieces that fall into place. You know, I guess if you have a vision, you may be more aware of the pieces and you know when they're in place. You know, I didn't have a full vision, but over the years, again, I was thinking about starting something that was probably going to be services. And when I was at Pop Sugar, we were in the full modern cloud data stack. It was an Amazon stack, Amazon Redshift. We were using Tableau. Oh, and I purchased Looker, which was a late stage startup at the time. This is like 2015, 16. And Looker is an amazing business intelligence platform.
You say you purchased them, you mean like you saw that acquisition go through or you just used the tool?
Sorry, I'm sorry. Yeah, but I purchased it for the company. Yeah, so I was running it with one of the vendors that, you know, we purchased their software from.
Got it.
So we rolled out that and it was just a really nice system. And so when I fully realized that, you know what, I've been at two companies in 10 years. I've seen two data sets, two sets of business problems. You know, I want to see 100 data sets and 100 companies and 100 business implementations or data implementations because I want to think of myself as a true expert. And I think the only way to do that is to see a lot of different variety, right? Of different technologies used in different ways and different industries. You know, then I could really walk into the next client I'm talking to and say, yeah, I've been there, done that. This is exactly how you should do things in this situation, you know, for your industry or for your data set or for your use case. That's what I wanted. And I realized I was never going to get that without consulting and getting out there and being a part of a lot of projects. Well, because I was, I knew a lot of the folks at Looker because it was a small company and I was a customer. It was very easy for me to turn around and say, hey, I'm going independent. I'd like to start a company and I'm going to start by using your technology. I love your technology. I want to become an expert at Looker, or I am an expert at Looker really, but I want to help your customers. You got to have a lot of customers that need help. Help me out. Give me a couple of customers. So within about a month, I had a client or two that I was working with independently by helping the Looker sort of customer success folks and product folks. And that worked. So I started doing that and I was able to then bootstrap this. And I've been growing the company ever since with the vision of a full stack data consulting firm. That's always been the vision of Data Climber. And now we're almost 50 people strong and full stack data engineers.
Did you replicate that first strategy with other tools as an idea, as like a way to acquire customers, or what happened? Because I think that there's a lot of steps between two clients and 50 employees.
Yeah, you know, I did though, because I grew the company at first based on my partnership relationships. So it was all about partnerships. I was not going out and getting my own leads and my own, you know, prospects. I would talk to my partners. So at the time, Looker was my first partner. And so, yeah, absolutely just relied on them for prospects. And, you know, I would either come into a brand new lead they would have, and sometimes I could help with solution architecture. You know, often bringing me in free sale was great, right? Because I had a lot more experience than the sales rep. I wasn't, you know, a practitioner. I had tons of experience with data warehousing in general. So I could talk about everything from data strategy to the technology, to best practices and design patterns and all of that. So I could actually expedite a sale. So I think that helped a lot. So on the one hand, having my experience did help quite a bit because I could really speak to prospects at a lot of different levels. And then at the same time, could also be brought into an existing customer who is struggling with something. Now, they may have implemented spaghetti code and the whole thing was a mess. Performance is an issue, what have you. You can still always definitely implement technology in the wrong way. We'd fix that and talk about how we'd provide health checks to clients. And so just providing both of those services with a partner was a way to get me going for sure. For my, say, 5-10 people, I was able to hire those folks along the way and grow the number of projects we were working on. And just it's all about relationships. Business is about relationships everywhere. And so the relationship was just really important. And then over time, I just expanded the number of partners I was working with and grew the company that way.
What was your order for, like, at what point you needed to bring people on? So did you need to just, like, you got flooded with technical work and you're like, I need more technicians, or you're like, there's not enough work anymore, people to bring in business? Or, like, what was, like, essential at the very beginning first?
Yeah, you know, I've always, that's one of the hardest part about bootstrapping a company is you have to make sure that you're profitable as much as possible and yet growing. And so balancing supply and demand is always on our minds. I was simply able to find people quickly, you know, quick enough that when I knew a project was coming and I'd have maybe 4 or 6 weeks sometimes advance notice, and I was able to find people and hire through my network. I already knew a lot of folks I found ways to bring people on early. So it was just a balance. I would always try to look at the demand or what projects were likely coming down the pipe. I would definitely start my own recruiting efforts in tandem with that. And I was always able to fill the demand need kind of amazingly. I'm trying to think of the time when, there wasn't much of a time when we were in having any big crisis. You know, we were always able to meet the demand pretty well. So I don't know, it's kind of an art of trying to balance those things as you go. But that's what we would do for sure. We would get a project, make sure we had we didn't have enough people to staff it. We'd hire a few people. And I personally would do all the training and onboarding, and I was doing everything, and I just make sure it worked. A lot of times people were working, you know, I would be the face of the project, and I had people helping me, you know, behind the scenes.
Yeah. And now today you have some incredible clients. Among them are multiple NFL teams. What kind of problems would a sports team come to you with? And then what kind of solutions do you provide for those problems?
Yeah, no, that's a great story too, just how we got into sports. It's fundamentally the problems we're solving for major league sports teams are the same problems we're solving at our other clients. You know, it always comes down to data warehousing, creating a single source of truth for data for the organization so they can get a 360 degree view of the customer or the product or what have you. You know, that's kind of the goal of data warehousing. And so for sports, it's a 360 degree view of the fan, and really understand how to engage those fans as optimally as possible, you know, to fill seats for every game and make sure that you have high fan engagement across the board. And you got a lot of fans, even outside the stadium, you know, 80% or more of fans don't actually go to a game ever. They're out there just watching the games on TV. And so how do you engage that audience, things like that? And I was, again, fortunate just to be able to start in that vertical by getting introduced to the San Francisco Giants when I was in the Bay Area, small company. They wanted to invest locally in a small business that was going to help them, you know, locally. They were sitting there right in Silicon Valley, you know, take advantage of the talent right there. No need to go anywhere else, right? And they understood early on even that the ideas of a modern cloud data stack and kind of going cloud and just making sure, you know, understanding that this technology existed out there that was going to make it a lot easier for them to do their data and analytics. They really didn't have anything before that. So they really were working off of spreadsheets and standard databases like Microsoft SQL Server that aren't data warehouses. And they were struggling like a lot of companies out there, right? Major league teams turned out to be about like a mid-sized business. They're usually 300 to 600 people. You know, they're not gigantic. And they have all the same data problems that any mid-sized business would have, really: data silos, slow data, not able to get answers quickly, all of those things. So they were looking for just that basic like data warehousing need. You know, can we just engage our fans? Can we run a campaign tomorrow and, you know, calculate how many net new fans we just created, or customers really we created that day or with that campaign, because it takes us 2 weeks to do it right now. You know, that's kind of the where they were. Fast forward to today, they're just super excited that they built a stack, and they're running the entire business off of that stack, and really enjoying the flexibility they have by able to being able to do whatever they want to do with it. I forgot the story of that. Just as interesting, I was actually traveling in overseas. I was in Amsterdam for a week, just kind of on vacation, and I got a call from one of the Looker sales reps I'd worked with. He's the one who knew the San Francisco Giants contact, and he said, "Hey, I want to introduce you to these guys. I think they could use your help." And it wasn't even his account or his, you know, lead. It was just somebody he knew in his network, but he knew that they needed help. And so I connected with Rocky Koplik, who's the VP of engineering, analytics and data at the Giants. And he was up at midnight, and it was 8 a.m. my time in Amsterdam, and he wanted to have a call. So he talked to me at midnight San Francisco time, and we hashed out a plan, and the rest is history. So that working with the Giants is what got us into all of the rest of the teams and the leagues we're at now. Again, word of mouth, referrals is how that all works. And we just made our name for ourselves in that specific vertical. It's been really, really great to be there.
Would you also be the person providing insights for these people, or are you just giving other people the tools to then go into their own data in ways they previously weren't able to?
Yeah, it's a little more of the engineering side of things and making sure they have the system and the data is modeled in a way that is really easy to use for the other systems or for the end users. We do some of the analytics to help them out, but often, you know, they have teams doing that, right? They have marketers, they have sales reps, they have the analysts even that, you know, whose job is sort of to figure a lot of this stuff out, pricing analytics for seat ticket prices, all of that. So we're often just enabling them to be able to do those jobs in a much, much more efficient way with much cleaner data too. You know, that's the other big value add that we've been able to bring the teams is a golden record of their fan, or a single, you know, record of the fan with a lot of data amalgamated and deduped into a single record. And when we did it at the Giants, for instance, we reduced their fan database by 15%, which sounds like that's a problem, but that's actually great. That means they had a lot of duplication in their data. And when they were sending out emails or advertisements, they were targeting the same person twice, three times, right? And it was probably kind of a mess from a fan standpoint, the customer standpoint. So to be able to dedupe all that, create a clean record, you know, one row per person, and understand who they are, understanding their purchasing history, understanding everything they can about how to talk to them better, how to engage with them better as a fan. That's the kind of thing that they could now do. They actually didn't have that capability before we came on the scene.
Would it be fair to say there's kind of like a supply demand in that perspective, in terms of like it's easier to find someone who can like work with numbers that are accurate than it is to find someone who can build it, like architect a system? So is that kind of like, would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, absolutely. I find that true. And that's kind of why we're a business. I think is that a lot of people can do, kind of know what they need to do and can do it, but they just don't have the data or the skills or just don't understand how to get to that point. And so we help them along that part of the journey, and enable, all their data driven efforts, if you will.
How has the no code wave, if you will, maybe it's hype and maybe it's not, maybe you can express your opinion on that, but kind of this big, I don't know, maybe just, I think we all have this tendency to like assign when we plugged into a movement as the start of that movement. So I'm about to just commit that fallacy here, but the no code hype is something I started to notice kind of like right at the beginning of the pandemic. Maybe that's because that's when I got more online. But how has that changed things? Because now I feel like there's a lot of things people can do, like Zapier, right? That wasn't a tool probably when you started. Well, I don't know when you started this business, but at least in 2008, it wasn't a tool. And all of these other just platforms that automatically one-click integrate all your sources and do all these things for you off the shelf, you know, no expertise needed. Has that affected anything? What have you run into with that changing kind of dynamics of the whole industry?
Yeah, you know, I welcome a lot of those tools. I want things to be automated as much as possible, and it's easy to automate, you know, for end users. However, it's always more complicated than you think. Kind of the bottom line there. And that's why having some expertise in data is still a big requirement in my mind to do anything properly at your company, especially if you want to do it at a company-wide level and kind of do it right the first time. Data is still difficult. You can sync data in with a click of the button using Fivetran, but it still can be quite a mess. It still can be dirty. It still can be giving you the wrong signals. The other piece of it that vendors are still working on, but it's never going to be perfect, is data modeling. And I feel like that's the art of a lot of what we do. Raw data is really hard to interpret and use, no matter how well it's been attempted to be brought in, clean from these sources. And so there's always a lot of transformation from a raw, very just difficult to use data set that has a lot of things in it that you don't understand as an end user. Maybe one or two people in your whole company would be able to interpret the data essentially and tell you what it's really means. So turning that into something meaningful and very easy to use for 1,000 end users is still quite a task. And it's something that we do well because we have all the experience doing data modeling and data warehousing. So there's a lot of steps that still require a decent amount of thought and taking best practices and design patterns that have been developed over many, many years for the problem. But it's great. I would love to be able to walk into a company and say, 80% of what you want to do is pretty much plug and play. And we can get that stuff going in a week, or a day even, get some stuff running. But you know, it's always that 20% that you really want to be careful about and can cause lots of headaches and time, sinks later on if you don't take care of them up front.
Day to day, what are you most enjoying these days at this stage of the company where you're kind of sitting at the top? I don't know if you're diving into spreadsheets or looking at rows of data every day, at least client facing. Like, what is it that you're focused on at the moment and that you're finding the most enjoyable?
Yeah, no, we don't use spreadsheets. That's what we try not to do.
I realized it when I said it. I was like, Thrawn, rows, tabular data, but non-spreadsheet tabular, maybe.
No, I'm personally, again, because I enjoy so many different things and I find that I want to understand so many aspects of everything. I mean, I think that's why I got into engineering in the first place. I want to understand how enterprise software worked. I want to understand how these things work. But then I like to explore all sorts of different avenues around that, whatever it is, that subject. I want to keep going and understand the complete picture. So if I'm working in data for a business, I also want to understand the business. I want to understand the customers. I want to understand everything. And so I'm really enjoying running the company at this stage where I am out of the day to day. I used to play, wear every hat in the company over time. And I've slowly been able to hire the right people that can do things better than I can for sure. And, I hand off lots of different roles and responsibilities to different teams and folks. And now, I'm really enjoying spending more time, just thinking about the future of the industry, where we're going, and talking to clients more and more, really to truly understand all of the different ways that our work is impacting the business and looking for the business outcomes. It's amazing how hard, how hard that is for a lot of companies to actually really measure the value of data specifically. So we're trying to help customers, do that and then promote that as well. So just a lot of thought leadership. And doing things like this, having interesting conversations about the industry and about the technology we use and all of that.
Is there any part of your life where you use data like personally that other people would not? I'm sure, the lens through which you look at life is probably has a data filter, but does anything come to mind?
That's a really good question. I've definitely thought about doing that a lot. I don't know if I have a great answer to that. Yeah, it's kind of sad. I know there's an answer to that. What have I done? I've definitely put some spreadsheets together in my life, personal life, and figured some stuff out. I think I've just spent most of my time focusing on much bigger data sets for bigger clients than myself.
Let's do a couple bonus questions here. And, sometimes we break our own rules. If there's a question we meant to ask earlier that's not so bonus themed, we don't really get so upset with ourselves. But you said you've lived in a lot of really interesting places growing up. What would you say is like the most obscure of those places?
It's an interesting question. They're all fairly obscure. It's probably the first one. So when I was 5 years old, I lived in the Philippines for a year. And it wasn't just like a big city, Manila or something in the Philippines. It was a small island in southern Philippines. So it was really a tropical paradise. That's my first memories are playing on this white sand beach, this pristine beach, the huge coral reef right off kind of the front door, basically. I think I snorkeled most days of the year with my mom. And I lived right next to this really poor fishing village, and I would just play with the kids and learn how to make kites out of like trash bags and, you know, all sorts of kid stuff. And so it was one big adventure. Even that place, again, very obscure. I was so young, I didn't really know better, right? And I just a side note, I mean, I'm really, really fortunate that I had that experience, because I've gone back there 30 years later or something, and the whole place was destroyed. You know, reefs are gone. Dynamite fishing has destroyed a lot of the environment around there. There's just so much environmental damage going on in the world. Plus, global warming is also killing the reefs. So it's amazing how fast things have changed. But that was a pretty obscure place. After that, I lived in Malaysia for a year in Kuala Lumpur when I was in a little older, and 13, 14 years old. Kind of obscure, not as much anymore. New Delhi, India. So variety of places that are somewhat obscure, and we're very, very, all very, very different, right? But we every few years we would always live overseas. And so, you know, what I took out of that was everybody in the world, I feel like people are the same. Wherever you go, you know, there's good people everywhere. Everybody wants very similar things. We all want to have great connections, family, friends. We want to have a whole social network. We want to have safety, happiness, success, all that stuff, right? And so everywhere you go, you know, you're going to find just people are really good in general, and we're all here together. So I was really glad that I was able to travel a lot and figure that out. It's really governments that get in the way in my mind.
Yeah. Have you done any extended living abroad as an adult, kind of self-directed?
Yeah, another ironic thing. I've always wanted to and have not found a way to do that yet with my jobs and, I don't know, my family. Just haven't figured out how to live overseas, even though, again, like I would love to do that. So I've just done a lot of traveling, but never been able to live. Although, you know, maybe now that we're all remote and it's a little easier, maybe I should.
Yeah, I mean, you got the whole continent with the same time zones, just right south.
Exactly. Yeah, I like to think I'm a visionary. Started this company full remote 7 years ago when the pandemic.
That's early, very early.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's always been operated the same basic way. And yeah, we can't, you know, people do travel quite a bit with the company. A lot of people do actually go down south, Central America, South America for stints.
You mentioned briefly early on that you love to be outside. Do you have a favorite hike, or is there an experience outside that, you know, is your favorite, whether it be camping, hiking, something like that?
Oh, man. Yes. I don't know. It's hard to pick a favorite. I still to this day think that one of the most spectacular experiences that I had was backcountry camping in Denali National Park in Alaska. You go off with your backpack and your compass, essentially, and your topo map. There's no trails, you know, and you just disappear for 10 days in the wilderness. So that was pretty roughing it. There's grizzly bears everywhere, but it's great because the wildlife's actually scared of you, as it should be. And, you know, you don't run into any big problems. So wildlife. So I loved that. That was just a pretty magical experience. Same thing in Glacier National Park. I've done the same kind of thing there for 10 days and go back in there, and it's pretty wild and very beautiful. So yeah, those are two. The other one that I definitely should mention that was just very interesting and unique experience was, this is back in college, but I spent a whole semester in this program called Sea Semester that's out of Woods Hole, Massachusetts. You spend 6 weeks sailing on a 125-foot schooner, usually in the Caribbean. So my route was from Miami, Florida, all the way down to Cuba, past Cuba, all the way down to Colombia, kind of came back up. So we sailed around a lot of the Caribbean for 6 weeks. And, you know, that was an amazing outdoor experience. I mean, I saw so many different things. And the only downside was I figured out that I'm very seasick. You know, it's very easy for me to get seasick. I was like the worst one on the entire ship the entire time, and I never got better. So it's amazing how you can look out the bad memories, you know, from an experience like that.
That was a great answer. I love that. One last question for me. How do you deal with fear?
You know, you face it. That's the first question. That's the first answer. And it's taken me a long time to figure that out. You know, literally facing directly into your fears and, you know, and just going through it, you'll find that 99% of the time, it's not as bad as you thought. Yeah. I mean, that's truly it. You just go through it. You don't avoid it. You know, whatever you're scared of, seriously, just face those fears. There's a reason that phrase exists, right? And it's true. And it takes a lot of guts sometimes, because you don't know what's on the other side. But I think people in general, you know, most of us are geared to be fearful of a lot of things. That's why fear really takes hold in a lot of places in our lives. But again, if you personally just went through, just go back and look at your own history and look at something you were afraid of and, you know, tell me if you actually tried to address it and get through whatever that was it as bad as did your fears come true? And I'm guessing the answer is no in almost all cases.
I love that. The 0.001% of the time, though, that the fears you die, right? Is that what happens?
Perhaps. Depending on what you're facing, yeah. If you're a free soloer, then maybe.
Yeah, free soloer or a storm chaser. I don't know if storm chasers have fear, right? That might be the whole point. Getting out of my depth here. But you shared that thought leadership is kind of a lot of your main professional focus now. What is it you're seeing technically on the horizon shaping that you're kind of excited for? You know, you're going to be one of the first companies to be doing this new thing that's kind of on the frontier of the data world.
Yeah, you know what that is, and this is, I've always wondered why we have to have all these different systems to run a business, essentially. But what I'm excited about is the idea that data warehousing, which has traditionally been an analytics environment for mostly backward-looking, you know, analytics, looking at historical data, maybe doing some predictive modeling, but it's always been a side gig for the rest of the company. You know, it's informed a lot of decisions, of course, and it's helpful. But as I, a lot more recently too, we've seen this trend of pushing data warehouse data back into operational systems so that those systems can, you know, be better informed and essentially do more, you know, for less or do it more smartly or more optimally. And as that continues to happen, we're going to see a merging of operational applications and the data warehouse to a point where the data warehouse becomes an integral part of any company in terms of running the company and running the business. So, for instance, and I've been very excited about some of the technologies coming out lately that makes the data warehouse both a transactional database and a columnar sort of data store for large data. But if, you know, one of the big headaches of data warehousing these days is all the work to get data in and push data out. It's all the pipelines you have to build to move the data around. And I think we're going to see a day when most of the data doesn't move that much. It's all in the same place. Some of it's leveraged for your operational applications, like your marketing automation, your CRM, all of that will be storing its data in the data warehouse directly. And of course, your analytics and all that will be also built off the same data set. And so everything will merge into one more monolithic cloud environment. That's where I see this going. And I'm excited to build, you know, be part of this revolution of, I think, building more what a lot of the industry is calling data apps, where the whole application runs on a data warehouse instead of having its own data store. We have a couple partners like that. One is like Flywheel Technologies that have built a marketing automation tool that will read directly from your customer data set in your data warehouse. So we'll come in and build a clean 360 degree view of the customer. Their application will just leverage that data directly. And they still have to push some of the data back into marketing operation tools, you know, to complete the picture. So it's almost like a bridge between a future data app and where we are today. But I'm just excited to see the merging of these worlds of data and analytics and operational applications.
What's enabling that? Like, what innovation? Is that just cheaper storage, faster internet, and it's just that? Or like, what was developed that we can now do this?
Yeah, you know, every single big innovation in data warehousing over the past 10 years has helped a lot. Let me break that into two short answers. I'll try to make it short. One is, if you go back to when I was at Salesforce, 2008, 9, 10, let's say, with a Oracle data warehouse, there's no way you're going to run any kind of application on that because the query times were way too high. It was just too slow. Performance was really hard. It was hard enough to do analytics, much less build an application in there or have an application even read the data. You know, it just take too long. So all of the performance innovations that have come along in the last 10 years in cloud data warehouses make it a lot more feasible. You know, you can expose a lot of your analytics to your customers, let's say through your website or through an application now because it's pretty dynamic and you don't have concurrency issues anymore because you can plan for that and you can automatically handle performance in lots of ways. So there's that. But the most innovative thing is, for instance, we do a lot of work with Snowflake. And just this year, they announced this thing called Unistore, which means that they can store data that is meant for analytical applications. So for transactional, essentially read writes, you know, very quick that most applications need in the same place that you can be storing your columnar 10 billion row table that has a lot of the historical data generated by that transactional application. So the fact that you can run an application in the same environment as you're running your data warehouse and analytics, that's when it gets really exciting because the amount of real time or near real time updates you can get into all your applications at once, as well as your analytics, becomes really interesting. You know, when you're seeing most everything in real time and you're not having to wait sometimes days to actually see the full picture of what's going on.
Well, this might be my last question here, but a lot of the audience for the show is pretty young. What would you say makes someone like data a good prereq for someone who's interested versus not? Like, what kind of separates a good fit or not a good fit?
And by the way, you are hiring. Climbers hiring.
Yeah.
Big time.
Shout out those job openings.
We are hiring dozens of positions all across data engineering, analytical engineering, engagement management, sales, the whole thing. Yeah. So if you're interested in data, definitely check out our website. Thank you, Kyle.
And the remote roles. Sorry.
All remote. Yeah. 100% remote.
All remote.
Great benefits. The whole thing.
I hear it's good boss too.
I know. The boss is amazing. So it's a couple of things. One is curiosity. Now, I think if you're a curious person and you really want to find answers, you're going to do well in data because data is still hard enough that it takes a lot of work to actually get to the answer. So being curious, if you're not curious and you're not like sort of naturally curious, I think eventually it's not going to be interesting to you. The other aspect though is the technical side of things. If you are interested in just software development in general, that's one thing. And I think that's a great start. If you're interested in that, you might be interested in data engineering for sure. But, I find that, most people probably just confuse the two or don't realize how different they are. Let's put it this way. Data engineering is almost like night and day different than software engineering in my mind. And we have a lot of clients that fall into that trap of, you know, saying, well, we got a bunch of software engineers. We're a high tech company. We can build a data warehouse ourselves, you know, because we have technical people. But that's such a misunderstanding because the way you handle data and code data is totally different than, you know, building an application. But again, if you're interested in the technical side of things and you like organizing and structuring, and again, I think ultimately though, you have to be curious because you want to know how you're going to organize all this data to make a difference to answer a business question.
Awesome. Well, I think that's a good place to wrap things up. Stay curious, everyone. That's the final tip. If you want to be successful, probably in anything, data included. Aaron, where should we be sending people? I don't know if we have large enterprise listeners, but perhaps we do, and they might need help with, business outcomes.
Mostly mid-sized companies anyway. Actually, we're not doing a lot of enterprise work. But dataclimber.com, that's CLYMER, which happens to be my last name. The domain was available when I started the company, and it kind of made sense, so I went with it. So dataclimber.com, check out the website. If you /podcast singular, you'll actually get to this recording and some other podcasts we've recorded. So both places. And then I guess the third place is our careers page. Go check that out for sure.
Super fun. Thank you so much, Aaron. This is a great time.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. It's great talking to you both.
That is going to close out this conversation with Aaron Clymer from the company Data Clymer. Three takeaways for me, and then we will all just move on. One, the referral partnerships. I've actively been trying this in my own business since listening to this episode. Remains to be seen what the results are, but either way, very much a worthwhile strategy to try. I've gone on the phone with a lot of interesting people in the partnerships departments of the major software apps and tools I like to use in my consulting firm, and not something I would have thought of had it not been for this episode. So thank you, Aaron. Second takeaway is that working in tech in general is super fun because things are always evolving and changing so quickly. Not only does that create fun, it creates new opportunities because as new things emerge, if you kind of move quickly and learn them quickly, there's a lot of opportunity based on being the first to be good at something that is just emerging and exciting. And then the third takeaway is just for y'all to copy what I'm doing. I am currently, like I've said and kind of mentioned a couple times in this episode and just now, I'm trying to scale data analytics consulting firm. So what am I doing? I'm taking time with an expert like Aaron, someone 10 or more steps ahead of me, who's just given me all this extremely valuable advice and insight and stories and also just belief, right? Because it's like, he was at the end of the day, a regular guy and he found a way to do it. So I mean, it's going to take time and I'm going to have to learn a lot and try a lot, but I'm going to get there too. And it's super valuable to be able to learn from someone, again, a couple steps ahead on the journey or more than a couple. Anyway, copy what I'm doing. Whatever you're trying to do, whatever your goals are, find that guy who's ahead of you and can give you some advice. That's it for me in this conversation with Aaron. I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. Be sure you are subscribed wherever you are listening. That could be Apple Podcasts, that could be Spotify, that could be YouTube, and you'll know about the next episode. That's the magic of the subscribe button. Make sure you're following Aaron if you enjoyed what he has to say and you want to know the latest in data. You can see why I made that mistake now. And also be sure to check out Vasa if you're interested in hiring a virtual assistant to scale your operations and take work that's not the highest and best use of your time off of your plate. And also people just are usually better at it. Like my editor, she's way better at editing than I am. It's amazing. She gets to do it. I get to do the things I'm good at. Works out so well. So definitely check out Vasa if that is something you need help with. And not just for podcast editors. That should be self-evident, I hope. Anyway, share the show if you know someone who would enjoy it, or do nothing if you don't want to do anything. No obligation. The show's free either way. No matter what, I am grateful to you for listening. I will see you next time. Bye-bye.